Redeemer Adult Education presents Dr. Jeffrey Beshears speaking on the life and work of C.S. Lewis, A Mere Christian. In session 4, he discusses Prime Lewis. It was recorded on June 26, 2011 in Rudisill Hall at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Midtown Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay, well, thanks. Well, it's sure nice being with you. I've really enjoyed the time together. It's been an unmitigated joy, which is far better than a mitigated joy when you think about it. And maybe we could do a series sometime in the future. But it's been really wonderful getting to know some of you, and appreciate your attentiveness, your questions and comments, and so on. So we'll try to reserve as much time for input as possible this morning. So I'll do sort of a breezy summary of what we intended to do, cover some of Lewis's major works, but anything else about Lewis, his works or his life that's of particular interest, feel free to bring it up, and we'll address most anything that's relevant. Now I wanted to start off, as Dave mentioned, we have a four-page outline up here. If you don't have access to that, please help yourself. And on page 3 of that outline is Book 2 of Mere Christianity. And last week we only had time to get through Book 1, and of course that was only a very, very, frankly, embarrassingly thin, breezy summary of Book 1. There's so much good content in that book, as there is in the other three books of Mere Christianity. So I wanted to do an equally thin, breezy, superficial treatment of Book 2 in the next few minutes. And then again, any questions, comments you have, anything that would help broaden or deepen your understanding, we can talk about. Now, the title of Book 2 in Mere Christianity is What Christians Believe. And as we've said before, Mere Christianity is in no way a systematic theology. It's more like a primer in Christianity. It takes into account both Christian orthodoxy, what most Christians, most mainstream Christians throughout most of history have held in common in terms of doctrinal beliefs. And then it also deals with orthopraxy, how we put into effect in our own lives the belief system of the Christian faith. Now, in Book 2, in the first chapter, Lewis begins by talking about the problems of the problems of alternative worldviews. We have basically, when all is said and done, only three basic worldview perspectives. In other words, paradigms that people use in terms of making sense out of reality, making sense out of this world. And one would be a theistic worldview that would hold that there is a God who is the creator and sustainer of all that exists. And we can approach this from various perspectives, but frankly, it's the only sensible position. But there are alternatives, and a competing alternative would be that there is no God, there's only materiality, and that everything that exists came about as a result of material and naturalistic processes. And in philosophy, we refer to that as naturalism. Essentially, it's atheism, it's materialism, and so on. And frankly, it makes no sense. It can't begin to account for the most fundamental philosophical, theological issue, which is, why is there something rather than nothing? Have you ever thought about it? I mean, why should we believe that the fact that something exists is normative? Why would that be normative instead of nothing exists, including us? So naturalism can't account for that. They can't begin to account for the origins of life. Now, this search has been going on, as you know, in scientific circles for over 60 years. And from time to time, you'll read articles in scientific journals or popular journals that say that scientists, you know, are making progress, but still can't quite discover the key to the origins of life? Well, frankly, they don't have a clue. They don't have any more of an idea today than they did 60 years ago as to why life began. So naturalism fails on many accounts. It also provides, by the way, absolutely no basis, no foundation whatsoever for morality and ethics. A naturalistic worldview would inevitably lead to a nihilistic perspective, which totally negates any idea of right and wrong, good and bad, morality and ethics. Now, there is a third alternative, and that is pantheism, a view that, of course, is prevalent in Eastern philosophy. And likewise, it fails on the basis of logic and reason. So Lewis begins by discussing a little bit of these alternative worldviews. And sort of the highlight of Book 2, however, is Chapter 3, The Shocking Alternative. And that's what I wanted to spend just a few minutes on. He begins with the issue of free will. Now, we say that mere Christianity is basically basic Christianity. It's what most Christians have believed throughout most of human history. Now, having said that, I need to emphasize the point that Lewis was not in any way what you might call a hardcore Calvinist. He believes in free will within certain limitations. He doesn't believe that everything is determined and predestined, at least not in the sense that, again, extreme Calvinists would hold. And in that chapter, he talks about the key to history, how that what we find are these cycles in history where various civilizations rise as a result of certain social and other circumstances. They all begin to become very corrupt and stagnate and go into a period of decline and eventual collapse. And he's using this as an example of a previous tenet that he made in Book 1, which is that there's something wrong with humanity. Obviously, we're not pure and pristine and good. We continue to abuse and exploit and perpetrate violence and so on one another. And these are just recurring cycles in history because human nature is fundamentally flawed. Now, that leads us to the major point here, and that is God's redemptive work in history. Lewis begins by saying, you know, God in his great love for us has not left us in this cold, cruel world to just suffer without hope. And in fact, he has imbued us with a human conscience, a sense of right and wrong. And of course, that was a theme that he explored and developed very well in Book 1. And then he tells us that God has also seeded various cultures throughout the world with what he calls, quote, good dreams. In other words, these are mythologies that oftentimes hint at divine realities. Now, a lot of these mythologies, of course, get corrupted and perverted over time, but there always are embedded in these mythologies certain elements that are in keeping with the gospel, with divine truth. And then he tells us that at some point in history, around 2000 BC, that God revealed himself with more specificity in Hebrew and Jewish history, beginning with the calling of Abraham, beginning with the inspiration of the Old Testament scriptures and so on. God is trying to communicate again in his love for humanity with more specificity the moral requirements of God in order that we might regulate our lives individually and corporately and might live a more fulfilling life and a life that's more honoring to God. Now, then he comes to point 4, which he calls the real shock. And here he writes, and this is one of the most famous passages in mere Christianity. Now, among the Jews, there suddenly appears a man who goes about talking as if he were God. He claims to forgive sins. He says that he's always existed. He says he is coming back to judge the world at the end of time. Now, what this man is saying is quite simply the most shocking thing that's ever been uttered by human lips, or at least been uttered by a sane person. He goes on to say, by claiming to forgive sins, he implies that he is the one against whom we have committed those sins. Which is pretty audacious if you think about it. I mean, when you violate somebody else's rights and all, that's a sin against them, isn't it? But Jesus is talking about how that's actually a sin against him as well as the other person. And Lewis goes on to say, now, this only makes sense if he really was the God whose moral laws are being broken. In addition, Christ describes himself as, quote, humble and meek. Now, these are the very last characteristics that we would attribute to somebody making these kind of claims. So here's somebody who claims to be humble and meek, who says that he's existed forever, who implies that he is the Lord God of the universe, who set down the moral laws, and how every time we commit a transgression of the moral law, we are offending him. And so again, Lewis's point is this makes no sense unless, of course, he actually was the God of the universe who had incarnated himself in human form. So this leads us to, again, probably the most well-known and popular argument in mere Christianity, and we call this the Great Trilemma. And you see there in your notes, it comes from page 52 of the book. Lewis writes, now, what I am trying here to prevent anyone from saying is the really foolish thing that people often say about him. So sort of the common perception of Jesus is the most foolish perception of Jesus. And that is this, quote, okay, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Lewis says, now, that is the one thing that we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. In other words, he would either be a lunatic or he would be a liar. Now, you must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else he's a madman, or something even worse. Now, you can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any of this patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us, and he never intended to. So again, that basically is the core message of mere Christianity. I mean, that is, when you think about it, that is the gospel, isn't it? And again, much cited and sort of defines Lewis's whole approach to Christian apologetics. So he's telling us basically that Jesus Christ was either legitimate, he either was, in fact, the Lord of all creation, or he was crazy, he was a lunatic, or he was just an egomaniac who was trying to deceive people. He is a liar. And Lewis tells us those are options. And if you look closely at the life of Jesus and all, the latter two options eliminate themselves. Now, having said that, is that an adequate explanation? Many Christians, many who have studied Christian apologetics, say, well, that's a compelling argument. But is it really? Or is there actually a fourth alternative that Lewis fails to address? In other words, is there another possibility rather than just Lord, liar, or lunatic? In order to accept Lewis's great trilemma, what do we first of all have to accept to buy into his old argument? Yes? That the Bible is the Word of God. Yeah. In other words, we would have to accept that the representation of Jesus put forth in the Gospels and the New Testament is actually accurate and true. Okay? And so what if it's not? Okay, that opens up a whole fourth alternative, doesn't it? In other words, he may be something other than just a lord, the liar, or a lunatic. He could be a... Let's stick with the alliteration here. Can you come up with a nice L word for it? He could be a... I'm sorry?
Conspirator.
Okay. Can you convert that to an L word?
I was thinking about...
A legend. Okay, a legend. The whole Jesus story could be merely legendary. All right, now, of course, Lewis doesn't believe that. I don't think anybody who has seriously and fairly and objectively studied it would come to that conclusion, although there are many who would put forth that theory. So why is it Lewis does not even offer that up as a fourth alternative? Well, for one thing, it becomes a far broader and more complicated issue to deal with. And the chapters in Mere Christianity are very short, very poignant, very to the point. And so this would open up a whole range of issues that would have to be explored. Now, C.S. Lewis was probably... there was probably no one in the world who was more of an expert on literature and literary genres than C.S. Lewis. He was absolutely convinced when he read the Gospels, he was reading what we generally would refer to as ancient biography. Now, that's a little different from modern biography, but nonetheless, that's the genre that most scholars would place it in, ancient biography, including a lot of history. So, in other words, Lewis was absolutely convinced that when we read the Gospels, we are not encountering legend and pure mythology. We are dealing with actual events, an actual person who lived. So, in his mind, the whole legendary argument is really just a red herring put forth by atheists, skeptics, extremely liberal theologians, and so on, but it has absolutely no validity at all. Now, having said, and of course I would agree with him, but having said that, I do wish he would have written more extensively about the problem of the legend hypothesis, because that's actually the argument that's put forth most commonly today by skeptics who are trying to undermine the integrity and the reliability of Scripture and the whole gospel story. And Lewis, frankly, just rarely ever alluded to this. And when he did, he didn't really make the argument in any sort of detail. So I wish he had. Now, having said that, there have been, of course, great works in apologetics in recent years especially that do address that and refute that hypothesis. But in fact, Lewis's great trilemma should be a great quadrilemma. Okay, so I do think that's a weakness there in his whole argument. And then he finishes up book two by basically going back and recapping. Now, what is fundamental or basic or mere Christianity? And he says, well, essentially it's simply this. Jesus Christ died for us, and his death cleanses us from sin, and by his resurrection he triumphs over life. And Lewis tells us that is Christianity. That is what has to be believed. There are certain core doctrines of the Christian faith that are, frankly, non-negotiable. In order to claim to be a Christian, we must accept these certain basic core doctrines, and that's the point that Lewis is trying to make. So, again, that's an awfully thin, superficial, and probably not very satisfactory recap of Book 2. But are there any particular questions or comments you might have before we move on and look at some of his other writings? We'll adhere to our seven-second rule here. yes, please.
Getting back to the legend thing, in order for a legend to occur, doesn't there have to be some kernel of you know, wouldn't there have to have been a person for the legend to be built around?
And then
if you agree with that, wouldn't you go back to the trilemma? You know, wouldn't that bring you back to the trilemma?
Okay, so in other words, for a legend to accrue, you're saying it must, there must be a kernel of reality, a kernel of truth involved in it. Okay.
Was there a person to build the legend around?
Right, right.
A figment of somebody's imagination.
Okay, and Lewis would say no. If you were talking about myth, he would agree. If you're talking about legend, he would not agree. Okay, myth is basically a story that has a transcendent meaning and purpose. Okay, and Lewis would say that in that case, especially when it comes to Christian mythology, it's rooted in actual historical events. Legend, on the other hand, would be just something that was that could be totally fictional. Okay. Is that an adequate response to? Yeah, okay. Yes, please.
There were a number of other people that was a wee bit similar to Jesus at that time that went around and people had some kind of following, but I don't think it amounted to much.
No. There were in the from the time of Herod the Great, in other words, just a few years before Jesus, there were at least five or six pseudo-messiahs who came on the scene there in first century Israel. They were almost all revolutionaries, political revolutionaries, who were trying to overthrow the Roman imperial government. And they, almost all of them, there's, I think, one or two we're not sure what happened to, but most of them were eventually caught and executed by Roman authorities. And their cult, their following, very quickly fell apart, okay, with their death. Yes?
Since we're talking about Lewis as a scholar and about the Bible, sort of Augustine comes to mind in terms of how one of his difficulties as a young man was the poor translation of the Bible that he was presented with before Jerome. Mm-hmm. So a couple questions occur to me. Could Lewis read any of the original texts, and did he have a position on what translation of the Bible did he prefer? Was that important?
That's a good question. He at least could read. I'm not sure I would use the term fluent, but Lewis could at least read in, I believe, six or seven languages. And honestly, I'm not sure. I don't think Hebrew was one, but I'm pretty sure Greek was one. Your question sort of implies what we call biblical textual criticism. In other words, how can we be assured that the translations of the Bible that we read correlate to what was originally written? In other words, has the Bible been accurately transmitted and preserved through the centuries? That's biblical textual criticism. Kind of a misleading term, because biblical textual criticism actually just means biblical textual analysis. Okay, that word criticism is a little bit misleading. And if your point is, were there variations in the various manuscripts down to the time of Augustine? Yes. But as far as significant variances and changes in the text, no.
I was really thinking more in terms of some of our discussions currently. I guess, you know, he's Revised Standard.
I think the Revised Standard Version, wasn't that first issued back in the late 1800s, in the 1890s or something?
The Revised Standard was late 40s.
Well, but there was something back in
the American Standard and the New English, and the English translation.
Well, what was the first modern English translation back in the 1890s?
The English Standard.
English Standard, okay, and then, as you say, the RSV was more the 40s and so on.
I was just sort of wondering, was he reading the King James, and is that any significance?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a good question, because he doesn't really quote Scripture very much, so I've never really noticed if he's primarily using the King James Version or some other version. That's a good question.
You know, an interesting thing in itself is you talk about apologetics, because sometimes, especially in David's class, one thing that, and I think a discussion that goes on very much currently, is the need to refer to Scripture. So that's an interesting...
Well, and
the way that apologetics organizes its argument.
Right. Now, I think what we could say, though, would be that despite the evolution of the English language from Shakespearean times, King Jamesian times, to the present, again, the core message has not altered one bit. And so whether you're reading a version from several centuries back or fairly current, the core message there is going to remain intact. The variances that do occur are generally insignificant. Yeah. Now, shall we move on to some of his other writings, or did you have any other comments, questions about Mere Christianity in particular? All right. Well, let's move on then. And in your outline there, going back to page one, the front of the outline. Let's see. Given the time. Constraints. I won't try to cover all of this. Okay. Now, when Lewis comes to faith in Christ, which is about 1933 or so, not only does it reconcile a lot of psychological and moral issues in his own life, it also unleashes a prodigious literary flow that continues for the next 25 years. He is incredibly prolific during that period. The man, of course, is an amazingly gifted writer. By the way, he rarely edited his works. Almost all of Lewis's published writings were handwritten first drafts. And you look at some of these handwritten first drafts, and there are relatively few cross-outs and write-overs and so on. I find that astounding. You know, as a writer myself, I'm duly amazed. Now, over time, Lewis comes to see his mission in life as not just a scholar in medieval and Renaissance literature, but rather he understands that God has called him to be a Christian apologist, somebody who can articulate the basic message of the Christian faith, do it very, very effectively, do it in a way that's palatable and understandable to a common audience. And in particular, he's very concerned that in his day, the 1930s and 40s and beyond, Britain has become a very post-Christian culture. Secularism is just absolutely overwhelming that nation, and World War II doesn't help, to say the least. And so he sees basically his calling is as a missionary to British society, and I guess English-speaking societies in general. And in fact, when World War II first breaks out, he writes very very passionately that our primary enemy is not Nazi Germany or the fascists in Italy or whatever. Our primary enemy, what is rotting our culture, destroying our culture, is secularism. And so he understands that. He understands that there is a ferocious culture war going on in Britain in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and it supersedes even the more immediate threat of Nazism. Well, Right after his conversion, his conversion actually sparks his first theological work, which is called A Pilgrim's Regress. And, it's a sort of a play on words there. It's a spiritual journey that he's relating. And, of course, it's patterned to some extent or another on John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Now, the setting is basically an allegorical dream. And there's a protagonist in this story, a man by the name of John. And this man, John, has sort of a vague intimation, sort of a mystical vision of a distant western island. He's caught glimpses of this land a few times since his childhood during periods of intense longing. And again, like so much of what Lewis writes, this is patterned after his own life experiences. Remember, we talked a couple of weeks ago about that first experience of joy that he had. This pilgrim, John, in the story, is guided by this bright figure called Contemplation. And so John abandons his home and family, and he pursues his destination. Now, by the way, it's interesting that Lewis calls his spirit guide Contemplation. He doesn't call him Reason or something like that. C.S. Lewis was a very, very rare Christian in 20th century history, I think. He's a man, of course, who has an extremely brilliant intellect. And oftentimes the tendency is to consider Lewis to be this great rationalist. And he, in a sense, was that. But he's also a great contemplative Christian as well. He has a very, very deep spiritual life that he develops as a result of practicing the traditional spiritual disciplines. And so you might say there's an attempt here on his part to integrate what we might call sort of right brain and left brain orientations. He understands that our model, our pattern in life is no man, no woman, but only Jesus. And in Jesus, we find the only perfectly healthy individual who ever lived, mentally healthy individual, a man who perfectly incorporates the mind, reason and the life of the mind, along with a deep, intimate spiritual life in God. And so Lewis apparently knows this or senses this intuitively early on. And he is by nature very much of an intellectual and a rationalist, but he understands that's really not what the Christian faith is all about. The Christian faith is about cultivating a deep and intimate relationship with God through the Holy Spirit. And so he's going to be guided through this journey, spiritual journey, by Contemplation. Now, there's several interesting things that come out of this book, but one that's oftentimes cited is Lewis's argument from desire. He comes back to this in several of his writings, and this is basically his argument. And that is that just as the fact that we experience thirst is a proof that we're creatures for whom the drinking of water is natural. In other words, the reason we have this desire, this craving, this thirst, is because we were made to consume liquid, water, preferably. And likewise, the fact that we desire something that our natural world cannot supply suggests the existence of another or supernatural world. And so, all along the way, this pilgrim, John, is being tempted by all kinds of distractions in life. Fortunately, he doesn't have iPads and cell phones and things like that and the internets, but nonetheless, even in his day, there's plenty of distractions, plenty of ways to just mindlessly waste one's life. He's also distracted and tempted along the way by all manner of pleasures, sexual and everything else. There's all kinds of intellectual traps that are laid for him. And he has to encounter everything from the arguments against Christianity by secular humanism to Freudian psychology to Marxism to, again, all manners of hedonism, pleasure seeking, and so on. He has to encounter the temptations of the occult, and he also has to deal with liberal theology. Now, each of these presents some problem or issue related to Lewis's own life. So again, he's writing in large measure out of his own personal experiences. Now, the pilgrim here, John, discovers that sex, for instance, just to use one example, is merely a shadow of the reality of love. In other words, what sex does is just attempt to apprehend a greater reality, a greater sense of intimacy. And he discovers, for instance, that aesthetics, in other words, the pursuit of beauty, art for art's sake, this cannot satisfy the void in his soul. So he really turns on to beauty. And, you know, this world is full of it, isn't it? I mean, this is an exquisitely beautiful world in many respects. And people can really, really be transfixed. But, you know, ultimately, it really doesn't satisfy. I mean, it can certainly enrich our lives, but it doesn't really satisfy our deepest longing in life. Now, like the real life Lewis, this pilgrim comes to realize that all pleasures are really just substitutes for what we're really pursuing, and that is true joy. Remember, we said a few weeks ago, Lewis uses this word joy because it's really the best term he can come up with for the deepest longing of the human heart. Okay, it's really a striving for oneness and intimacy with God. So he calls it joy by default. Well, I suppose, how is it different from happiness? I suppose Lewis would probably say that happiness is more conditional. Happiness depends on if you're feeling satisfied and fulfilled in life, whereas joy is more of a transcendent longing. One of his traveling companions, by the way, is a man named Virtue. And Virtue is very rationalistic. Virtue is very self-disciplined, as the term implies. Virtue is very well-intentioned. But you know what? Virtue lives life without passion. And so even virtue is not joy. Even virtue, a rigid, self-disciplined, upright, honest, you know, life, that also doesn't really suffice. So in the course of his travels, the pilgrim realizes that he needs to steer a middle course between hedonism, pleasure, and rationalism. And here Lewis is picking up on the old Greek concept in ancient Greek philosophy of sophrosyne, or in other words, moderation in all things. This was a real key to some of Socrates' teachings, and Aristotle also perpetuated this idea of sophrosyne, moderation in all things. You know, at this point, I guess I'd sort of have to nitpick a little bit. I think if we look at life as a balancing act, we might be missing a lot. In my mind, our real challenge in life is not moderation in all things or a balancing act, but rather perfect integration. And with perfect integration, we fully embrace pleasure and beauty and love and so passion and so on. And we also fully embrace reason and justice and truth and so on. And again, with Jesus, I wouldn't characterize Jesus as a well-balanced person. I would say this is somebody who perfectly integrates all the virtues in life. Anyway, I think for time's sake, probably we ought to move on here. But Pilgrim's Regress, Lewis's first theological work, and certainly a fascinating one, and certainly worth one's time in working through it. And he does introduce a lot of themes that will come up on a recurring basis, you know, in some of his other writings as well. Anything briefly before we move on? Okay. Now let's go down to the middle of the first page there. And just a brief aside, it is sort of an aside. This is not a book, it's merely an article he wrote, Why I Am Not a Pacifist. And Lewis is a conscientious Christian, but he's not a conscientious objector, okay? And he's profoundly disturbed by the outbreak of World War II, but he does believe that Britain has absolutely no honorable alternative except to oppose the spread of Nazism and Nazi aggression. So he basically sets forth his view on war in this little essay, Why I'm Not a Pacifist. And Lewis, first of all, addresses this issue. Well, look, when it comes to issues like war and peace and pacifism or whatever, shouldn't the rule be follow your conscience? And Lewis says, well, wait a minute. That's really not adequate to just throw that out, follow your conscience, because our conscience actually has to be conditioned by certain things, such as the moral requirements of natural law. We've spoken about natural law a couple of previous sessions, natural moral law, which Lewis saw as universal and absolute. And so Lewis is saying, well, look, our conscience needs to be informed by the moral standards and requirements of natural law. And furthermore, our conscience needs to be informed and conditioned by the realities of human nature. If we have a distorted view of human nature, then our inclinations, our conscience, may lead us in the wrong direction. Now, with that, he addresses the issue. He says, historical facts, frankly, do not support the pacifist position that all wars do more harm than good. They all do a lot of harm, but do they all do more harm than good? In other words, what is the net result? And Lewis says not all wars, the net result would be that they just add to all the evil and the injustice in the world. And he says, many Christian pacifists would argue that what we need to be doing is converting more and more people in these nations to pacifism. And Lewis says, well, wait a minute. Again, see, in keeping with the realities of human nature, I don't believe that's advisable because, in the first place, only modern democratic liberal nations tolerate pacifists. They're not tolerated in authoritarian, totalitarian states. Those states murder, kill, execute, or otherwise persecute their pacifists. And so Lewis says, the increase of pacifists in a liberal nation like Britain, like America, and so on, would only make those nations more susceptible to conquest by their totalitarian neighbors. And, I don't want to get into a prolonged discussion of this, but why is it that, for instance, Gandhi was tolerated by the British in India? Well, it's because at that point in their history, the British had evolved to a point where they were not a repressive, totalitarian, authoritarian state that murders their dissidents. Now, he was, of course, harassed and even imprisoned at times. And as we've said before, when you're talking about human societies and all, we're talking about shades of gray here. And certainly, British society and culture was a whole lot more preferable, to what was going on in Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany at the time. And so it's only liberal nations, liberal democratic nations, liberal being used, of course, in the pure sense, the pure political sense of the term, only liberal nations tolerate pacifists. And you know, what that would do is set the stage for more ruthless regimes to dominate the world. So any comments quickly before we move on? I sure don't want to get bogged down in this, but and I'm just giving you Lewis's view on this, of course. Yes, Bridget?
Just very, very quickly. I totally agree with what you just said when it comes to war, peace, their lines, when they need to be war and all this. But I think some people would say, where does it come in that one is supposed to turn the other cheek?
Mm-hmm.
And that might present a problem.
Okay. So what about Jesus's admonition to turn the other cheek? In other words, don't resist an evil person, turn the other cheek. And Lewis actually does address that in this essay. And he basically says that this is a mandate Jesus is giving us for handling personal conflicts in our daily life. It's not a general principle to be applied to nations and issues such as war between nations. And he points out that both the apostles Peter and Paul sanctioned the use of force by governing authorities when it was justifiable. So again, whether you agree or not, that's basically Lewis's position. Yeah. Point.
What
yes, please.
What do we say about today's revolutions in the Middle East? That they're justified or... That's not the way to approach things.
I'm only speculating here that as far as current revolutions in the world, in the Middle East, and so on. I'm only speculating. I assume he would probably say you take it on a case by case basis, and you know, perhaps it would come down to simple pragmatics. Is the net result going to be positive for humanity, beneficial for humankind, or is the net result going to be worse for humanity and humankind?
A human rights person? Human
well,
person,
I guess that's a fair... Yeah, I would he be considered a human rights advocate? Well, I assume so, I guess, depending on exactly how we would define that. Uh-huh. Well, let's move on, and let's see, we have 15 more minutes, is that correct? Yeah, okay. Why don't we, since we are a little bit short on time, on page 2, there are a couple of books I wanted to mention, and then in the time we have remaining, we can talk about most anything else that's of interest. One is The Abolition of Man, and then the one following, The Great Divorce. And now, when it comes to his work, The Abolition of Man, written in 1944, so World War II has been going on now for 5 years in Britain, 3 years in America. This is a book that's influenced by G.K. Chesterton's great work, The Everlasting Man. And basically what this book is I think, a very astute analysis of the philosophical and moral decline that we see in Western civilization. Or basically, as Lewis would say, how the modern world has gone wrong. Now, at the same time that Hitler and Stalin are terrorizing humanity, Lewis says that, look, we've got people among us. We have modernist philosophers. He's thinking of people like A.J. Ayer and Bertrand Russell, who are trumpeting moral relativism. There's also the beginnings, by the way, of postmodern thought back in the 30s and 40s as well. Now, Lewis starts his argument with a basic premise, and that is the ancient Chinese concept of the Tao. Until recent years, when that word was translated into English, it was often spelled with a T, like Tao, but it's actually Tao, and now in most modern English writings, it's spelled D-A-O. But basically, the Tao is the way, in other words, the natural order of things. And Lewis cites various law codes in ancient and medieval cultures that support the premise of a universal ethic. In other words, this concept of the Tao. Now, he begins his critique with the popular modernist assumption that all aesthetic judgments are merely subjective. In other words, there is no such thing as beauty. Beauty exists only in the mind of the beholder. And he critiques that view. And then he argues that all true education, including art education, as well as everything from philosophy to art, is based on universal virtues. And Lewis makes the point that there has always been a system of values accepted by most civilizations that recognize a universal law of moral absolutes. In other words, as he calls it, a generally accepted standard of right and wrong. However, the reality of moral absolutes, he says, is no longer generally accepted. I think we mentioned maybe in our first session Alan Bloom's great book back in the 1980s, The Closing of the American Mind, in which Bloom, a professor in education at the University of Chicago, writes that there's one truism that every college, university professor can accept. And that is that when he looks out at his students, virtually all of these people believe that there is no such thing as absolute right and wrong, absolute morality. Everything is relative. And that's the issue that Lewis is addressing here in The Abolition of Man. So there are universal values that in the past had been generally accepted, which now are no longer being generally accepted. And in fact, he tells us much of modern education, and of course much of popular culture as well, in fact not only rejects these absolute moral virtues, they ridicule them. And he says that this is to be expected, because after all, only those who practice the Tao understand the Tao. And here he's borrowing from, among others, Aristotle, who wrote that, you know, there is a form of intelligence that comes from just right living. Aristotle, many of you know quite well, was more of the common man's philosopher as opposed to his predecessor, Plato. Plato believed that in order to live a virtuous life, one had to be a great thinker, a great intellectual. And Aristotle says, no, that's not necessary at all. What's necessary in order to live a quality life is to live a virtuous life. And with a moral, ethical, virtuous approach to life, greater and greater awareness and understanding opens up. As we practice the virtues become more obvious. And that's the point that Lewis is making here in The Abolition of Man. So he says that so much of modern culture ridicules traditional value, and the reason is that only virtuous people understand virtue. And once we eliminate absolute moral values, he says, we abolish man as a moral being. And what happens when we abolish man as a moral being? Well, then there is no right and wrong. All of our disputes, all of our arguments then become merely power struggles. Say, in other words, anytime you and I would argue about something, we would essentially be saying, okay, now my understanding of this comes closer to the truth than yours does. And you would say, no, my understanding comes closer to the truth. But see, we're both appealing to some ultimate standard which would arbitrate our respective differences of opinion. And Lewis says that once that idea of an absolute moral standard vanishes, there's nothing left to appeal to, other than just brute force and power. And that's what we see going on in Nazi Germany and in Soviet Russia and so on. In other words, what we find in those countries is the law of the jungle prevailing. Might makes right. And it's every man for himself. And it's basically social Darwinism. It's survival of the fittest. And Lewis says, you know, even though these regimes like Nazism and communism hold forth this vision of a perfect utopian society, in fact, what they're leading us to is anything but utopia. They're leading us to dystopia. They're leading us to the most brutal, repressive, dehumanizing regimes in all of human history. So that's what's going on all over the world in the 1940s with the communists, with the Nazis, with the Japanese imperialists, and others. Now, also in this book, Lewis implores scientists, both natural scientists and social scientists, to return to this sense of the Tao, the natural order of the universe. And in the appendix, by the way, he sets forth some general principles related to the Tao, or related to what we've been talking about the last several weeks, natural law. And so if nothing else, you might want to buy this book and just take a look at the appendix and how Lewis sort of frames this whole issue of natural moral law. Now, I probably should say that Lewis rarely addresses politics per se in his writings. He certainly resisted identifying with any socio-political theory or ideology. But it's very clear from Lewis's writings that he's explored these areas very thoroughly, and he's basically what we would call a traditionalist. Now, he's not necessarily what we would call today a conservative. He's a traditionalist. His socio-political values are based on his understanding of natural law. And again, if you'd like some references sometime, just send me an email, and I'd be glad to refer you to some specific things he writes on politics and political theory. I think he writes with incredible brilliance and insight. But frankly, politics and ideologies didn't interest him a lot, or at least he had other priorities, I guess I should say. All right, and then let's look at briefly here the Great Divorce, and then any questions, comments you might have, and we'll sort of finish up with that. Now, this is one of Lewis's most ambitious novels. It's a true comedy in both senses of the term. In other words, it's very witty, thought-provoking, very amusing in places, but also, borrowing from people like Dante, Lewis is presenting here a journey from hell to heaven. Now, the theme here is that human beings choose their own destiny. Again, he's not in any way a hardcore Calvinist, okay? He does believe that human beings have the ability and the moral responsibility to choose right over wrong. Our ability to do that is not impossibly hampered by determinism. So many of the concepts he's putting forth here in The Great Divorce seem to be inspired by G.K. Chesterton's idea that hell is a monument to human freedom. And when you sort of think about that, well, that pretty much explains Lewis's whole perspective. Hell is a monument to human freedom. In other words, people go there because they prefer to go there. Okay, as odd as that might seem. Lewis writes, "There are only two kinds of people in this world. Those who say to God, 'Thy will be done,' and those to whom God says, 'Thy will be done.'" He says, "All that are in hell choose it." So in other words, don't blame God for sending people to hell. Salvation's accessible to all who choose. And God, furthermore, created us for infinite happiness, which is available to all who truly want it. However, our happiness has to come from God, not from other people. We can't possibly derive full purpose or joy in life through any other person, regardless of how loving and intimate our relationship with that person may. They cannot fulfill the void in the human heart. Furthermore, of course, any kind of success or power or money, status, any sort of thing cannot possibly fulfill the longing in our heart, the deepest longing in our heart. So what Lewis has here in The Great Divorce is sort of an interesting little scenario. There's a bunch of people on a bus, and they're traveling from hell, where they've been, toward heaven, But they have to want to make this trip. And in doing so, they have to give up their independence and they have to submit to the moral authority of God over their lives. And many of them choose to forego heaven rather than relinquish control of their own lives. In other words, they want to continue to be their own God. And they don't want to submit to the authority of Christ. And these are people, Lewis implies, whose God is basically their own ego. So along the way, we meet a very interesting assortment of egoists. We meet, for instance, a cultural elitist who feels like he's superior to everyone else. And this is keeping him from humble submission to the authority of God in his life. We also meet a very crude, pugilistic bully of a man, just full of anger and pent up, and not always pent up hostility. And he won't submit and allow God to control his life. We meet a couple of lovers who are very much in love with one another, and that matters more to them than their relationship with God. We meet a bitter communist who hates most everybody and everything. We meet a man a man who's absolutely obsessed with his own rights, as he calls it, and this matters more to him than anything else. We also, by the way, meet an apostate former minister who rejected Orthodox Christianity in order to advance his career here on earth. He's bought into modern liberalism, and that means more to him, even including jettisoning, getting rid of a lot of traditional Orthodox Christian beliefs, just so he can advance his ministerial career.
You're not going to leave out a lot of politicians, are you?
You know, that's a good question. Why no politicians? And I don't know. I don't remember him encountering one, but that would certainly fill it out, I guess you would say. So, yes, please, a question.
What you're saying fits right into today's lesson from Romans, because it talks about that we were slaves to sin.
Okay.
And then what is uncomfortable to me is that we become slaves to righteousness.
Yeah.
We choose to do that, but the whole idea, which is very anti-American, of slavery, you know, that we actually are willing to become slaves, and that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
It's freedom to choose that, but freedom to choose to be a slave.
Freedom to choose, and as we continue to cooperate with God's agenda for our life, we begin to exemplify more and more the qualities of the gospel. We basically enter into the process of sanctification, you know, to use the theological term. Yeah, good point. Anyway, I think I better end on that note. I think we do have a couple more minutes. And, by the way, up here on the table, I alluded to this last week. In our ministry, the Areopagus, we have a very systematic curriculum, a very in-depth seminary-level curriculum in Christian apologetics and Christian history, and also in contemplative Christian spirituality. This is our model when it comes to our apologetics. And again, I sort of alluded to this the other day, and you notice there that everything is founded on biblical truth. That is the foundation for it all. But in our curriculum, we cover again, in much detail, Christian history, apologetics foundations. In other words, what is Christian apologetics? What's the value and the need for Christian apologetics to enable Christians not only to understand their faith maybe in more depth, but also to be able to effectively defend the truth of the Christian faith. We deal with comparative worldviews. As I said, there are three basic worldview paradigms, but depending on how you subdivide these, we deal with 8 or 9 different options, including postmodernism, the New Age, nihilism or nihilism, existentialism, and so on. And then we deal with the theodicy issue, the problem of God and evil, reconciling the problem of God and evil, the historical quest for the real Jesus. We have a course on what we call a bibliology, in other words, dealing with biblical inspiration, canonicity, why were some books included and excluded from the biblical text, and the preservation and transmission of Scripture. When we read our Bible today, how can we read it with any confidence that what we're reading corresponds to what was originally written, given the fact that the Bible was hand-copied, you know, for 1,500 years up until the advent of the printing press? And then some special topics related to the afterlife, other religions, and so on. And then the ninth level in our curriculum, as you see there, is what we call frontline apologetics, responding to skeptics. In other words, all these challenges and allegations and arguments that are and questions that are brought forth by non-believers, how can we respond in a Christ-like, humble way, but upholding the truth and integrity of the Christian faith? So everything from Christians are hypocritical and arrogant. How would you respond to that? To you can't trust the Bible. It's been corrupted and perverted through the centuries. Well, how would you respond to that? So that's the nature of that course, which is really more of a workshop than a lecture course. And then cultural apologetics. How do we take the Christian faith and apply it to everyday life, including how we look at social issues and political issues and so on? So if you're interested, we offer these courses on a pretty regular basis. We have some opening up in the fall. And I guess people could just send me an email or something, or contact Dave here if you're interested in more information on these. I'm sorry for having to sort of rush through the conclusion here, as I really have enjoyed being with you all so much, and I've enjoyed the interaction, and hope we can, you know, maybe continue. One question. We have a Christian Study Center. It's in Cobb County, but we actually do a lot of our most everything in various churches throughout the Atlanta area. So we're probably doing it in a church near you, would be my guess. Coming to a church near you. Yes. And by the way, if you're particularly interested in knowing more about the ministry, I do have some brochures up here. But our website is www, of course, the Areopagus.org, and that's also spelled out here in the brochure. So, Dave, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity, and what a blessing it's been to be with you all, and continued blessings on your life. And thank you.